On behalf of the Indiana University Forum, I welcome you here tonight. We're very gratified with the turnout. We're sure it's going to be worth your time this evening. The Indiana University Forum was reestablished about 3 years ago by a group of individuals in the Indiana University community to promote and encourage the vigorous and active discussion of current issues and problems. The forum has operated in a number of ways, two ways particularly. It has itself sponsored programs regarding various topics that we felt were not being adequately covered in the community. For example, we had some programs, one on Mississippi, the schools and the Supreme Court, another one, Cuba, communism and the Cold War, another one, the significance of the Wallace vote following the primary elections of a year ago, still another one, which some of you may have attended, the two-part program on sex mores on the campus. Another function of the forum is to provide a vehicle or an avenue to any individual or group in the community which wants to get a point of view expressed or wants to have discussion regarding a particular topic. It is this second aspect of the forum's program which you see in action here tonight. The navigators, and then subsequently joined by the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, requested us to arrange a program of this type, which we were glad to do. And we certainly are eager to invite all of you, if you have a topic that you want discussed, to approach the forum. And we will be glad to see if we can arrange through our vehicle of this second arm method of expression, although it is close to finals, and I urge some of you to study for finals at least in the next 6 weeks. Tonight, we appreciate very much the participation of the panelists, and particularly the help of our winning debate coach, Mr. Gail W. Compton of the Speech Department, who will take over as mediator and moderate the forum. Mr. Compton.
There are a few slight changes in the program as is handed out to you. The changes occurred because printing deadlines always seem to arrive before people arrive, and so there are some slight changes. First, at the bottom of the program, there's a place where you, if you're interested in the manuscript, may leave your name and address. We are not at the moment promising a manuscript. It depends on the demand for this. So if many people are interested in a demand, then the two participants here will edit the manuscript to put it in a publishable kind of style instead of the kind of comments that we're making tonight. Same content, of course, but in a better format, perhaps. And so if you want a manuscript, so indicate on this program. If you happened to miss the program as you came in, simply leave your name and address on any slip of paper. Also, a brief slight change in the format of the program tonight. First, we will have Dr. Orr speak for 30 minutes, and then we'll have Dr. Scriffin speak for 30 minutes. And instead of a formal cross-examination period, they simply are going to have about a 10-minute discussion, the two of them. They didn't like the term cross-examination. Understandably, they're not really Perry Masons. They are trying to arrive at truth here, and so they will have a discussion. After that, there will be the period for questions from the audience, so if you have questions that occur to you during the time, please keep them in mind, try to phrase them succinctly and clearly, and we will deal with those questions later. And then at the end of the question period, there will be a final summary by each of the speakers for about 5 minutes. So we will try to keep within the time limits if we can at all. We have a timekeeper seated over here on our right who will stand when the time is up, and so this means for you in the audience, when he stands, you stop listening, because we hope the speaker stops speaking. Our two participants now, the first one is Dr. J. Edwin Orr, is from Los Angeles, California. He received his master's degree from Northwestern University, his doctorate from Oxford University in history and geography. His latest popular book is Faith That Makes Sense. Dr. Orr has traveled to over 140 countries in this world, which immediately made me ask, good heavens, how many are there? And he informed me there are 160. At one time, he even hitchhiked by land from Tokyo to Oxford. He is now a traveling lecturer under the sponsorship of the International Christian Leadership. Speaking negatively to the question, is Christianity credible? We'll have Dr. Michael Scriven, the well-known IU professor in the history and philosophy of science. Dr. Scriven received his MA in mathematics from the University of Melbourne, his doctorate in philosophy from Oxford. He is the author of some 3 books and over 100 articles. And so with no further comments, we will have the statement then by Dr. Orr, followed by the one by Dr. Scriven.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Moderator, Dr. Scriven, ladies and gentlemen. Confucius said that the meaning of words is perhaps the first thing in debate. And I'm reminded of something that happened in Los Angeles not so long ago. A man had chosen to do his PhD thesis on alcoholism. After the subject was chosen, he thought, well, why did I let them choose that subject for me? It's such a common phenomenon, drunkenness, that what new thing can I discover? And I must make a contribution to the field to get my degree. Then the thought occurred to him, if I could discover the common denominator in drunkenness, perhaps I could discover the cause of drunkenness. He found an old fellow on Skid Row who was willing to do the necessary research for him for nothing but the raw materials. On Monday, he got drunk with whiskey and soda. On Tuesday, he got drunk with brandy and soda. On Wednesday, he got drunk with gin and soda. On Thursday, he got drunk with rum and soda. And on Friday, he got drunk with vodka and soda. My friend said, what makes him get drunk? It's the common denominator. It's the soda. Now, you can see the fallacy in that statement. Actually, there's a hidden common denominator, the alcohol. So I think we should begin with a definition. I've been traveling in the Middle West and a little out of touch with correspondence, but I did write ahead to the sponsors of the debate regarding the title, Is Christianity Credible? I felt that in a single evening it wouldn't be possible to discuss, for instance, the Christian doctrine of miracles or, for instance, the nature of the Godhead. That would take a whole evening, if that. Or to discuss, for instance, soteriology or eschatology or any aspect of the Christian faith. So actually, I'd hoped that we would major, let me use the word major, on the Christian view of God, the Christian concept of God. And I'm going to make a definition, and this is my definition. It may not be my opponent's definition, but as a Christian, it's the definition I must work on. God is defined as the only, infinite, eternal, and unchangeable spirit, the being in whom all things begin, continue, and end. For the word credible, I just take the Webster definition, capable of being credited or believed, or worthy of belief. I would take the negative position would be incredible, or incapable of being credited or believed, or unworthy of belief. Now, I would like to say that as far as this subject is concerned, speaking of the existence of God generally, more particularly this Christian view, there are various attitudes that are common. One is that of the atheist who denies the existence of God. There is that of the skeptic who doubts the possibility. There is that of the agnostic who neither affirms nor denies, but may doubt or admit. And a rather unsatisfactory position it is. Then I've coined a word, I haven't seen it elsewhere. There's the protheist who admits the probability, but isn't overcome by it, and there's the theist who affirms the existence of God. Now, I'm a Christian theist. I hope that Dr. Scriven will make his position clear as we go along. Then we'll know exactly where we stand. It would save a lot of questioning afterwards. May I quote some well-known words to you? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The founding fathers attributed our human rights to God. Now, somebody might object and say, well, wouldn't the atheist fight for these rights just as much as a Christian? Of course. But perhaps you've missed the point. Our rights are not based on force or our fighting for them. Otherwise, it would be like inviting the Russians to fight us for them. There was an Irishman cutting across a state in Ireland belonging to an English duke. Whom should he encounter but the duke himself? The duke said quite pleasantly, you're trespassing, my man. This is my property. Said the Irishman, where did you get it? He said, from my father. He said, where did he get it? He said, from my grandfather. The duke was beginning to lose patience. And where did he get it? He said, from my ancestors, you impertinent bounder. Said the Irishman, where did they get it? He said, they jolly well fought for it. Said the Irishman, I'll fight you for it. You see, the founding fathers didn't say we have these rights because we fought for them, but they said we have them because God gave them to us. And this is written by a deist, Thomas Jefferson. Now, the founding fathers called this a self-evident truth. I'm not a professional philosopher. If I might use the word, if you're not scared, I'm an evangelist. Horror of horrors. What do we mean by a self-evident truth? Well, take the fact of existence. Philosophically, it'd be very difficult to prove your own existence. There was once a Chinese philosopher who dreamed he was a butterfly. In the morning when he wakened up, the dream was so vivid, he didn't know whether he was a man dreaming he was a butterfly or a butterfly dreaming he was a man. You may laugh at that, but many people hold that position. After all, we could be prisoners of our five senses. I remember on Morotai, when I was a chaplain with the 13th Air Force, one of our planes crashed. I had to pray with the dying and bury the dead. One poor boy was wrapped in bandages to the tip of his nose, totally blind. Lost his sight, totally deaf, lost his hearing, lost his sense of taste, presumably, his sense of smell, and he was losing his sense of touch. He was under heavy sedation. What did life mean to him? Nothing. Now, I do find people who hold the view that self-existence is an illusion, but they go down to the cafeteria and eat like anyone else. In other words, it's a sort of axiom, a self-evident truth we don't stop to prove. Now, the founding fathers said that faith in God is a self-evident truth. I have to be very careful with words. I would like to use the word awareness, but I'm going to use the word intuition, providing we'll not attach any different significance to it than the one I'm conveying. Somebody might say, why don't the savages have this intuition? They do. When the European arrived on this continent, he found a noble savage who was brave and cruel. He worshipped the sun, moon, stars, wind, and weather. But he had a word for God, the Great Spirit, and the European was able to communicate with him. I've worked as a chaplain in New Guinea among savage Papuans who also had an awareness of the supernatural. Certainly not a concept of Jehovah or of the God of the New Testament, but an awareness. You might say, what about the atheist? Why doesn't he have it? I find that most atheists do have it. To me, it's one of the striking things that those who profess to be atheists are so preoccupied with God, they won't let him alone. I have a friend called Michael Balester in California who was born in Russia. He learned to lip-read Russian to help his mother who was deaf. He said he had the time of his life lip-reading Khrushchev during his visit to the United States. When Khrushchev said under his breath, who's the big fat fellow over there? Am I supposed to know him? He didn't realize he's been read loud and clear 2,000 miles away. But my friend said to me, what amazed him about Khrushchev was how often that man referred to God. Someone shouted, how's your health, Mr. Chairman? He said, praise the Lord, pretty good for a man my years. Someone said, what do you predict in Russian-American relations in the next 10 years? He said, well, God only knows. He said on one occasion, may I quote an old Russian proverb? Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. The Chinese communists called him a Bible-quoting buffoon. It has occurred to me, if the John Birch Society or some one of them was able to say that President Eisenhower was a secret communist, perhaps it's actually the case that Khrushchev is a secret fundamentalist, and that's why he was removed. But forgive my fun. I find that atheists do have a concept of God, although they vehemently deny its validity. And we find that this awareness, intuition of God is in all races and tribes of men, all conditions of men, all classes of men, all sorts of men. any age group at all. And I think this awareness conditions us for faith. Now you may say, do you think this intuition of God, such as you call it, is a proof of God? Not at all. Not at all. But I say it conditions us for faith. Now, the Christian view of God is based on a divine revelation. You may consider this circular reasoning, but actually, you have to just simply state it. This is the Christian view, that it's based on the revelation given us by the Hebrew prophets and culminated in Jesus Christ. And the definition that I gave, that God is the only infinite, eternal, and unchangeable spirit, the being in whom all things begin, continue, and end, would be held, I take it, by a believing Jew or a believing Muslim. So we have a divine revelation, but how are we to accept this divine revelation? A sergeant said to me once, "Chaplain, you religious guys get me. He's a mathematician, can take you to the blackboard, an astronomer to his telescope, but you religious guys, you have to talk about faith, faith." I said, "Don't you see that faith is a kind of insight?" He said, "I don't get it." He said, "To me it's superstition." I said, "No, superstition is contrary to reason, but faith is agreeable to reason. There's that difference." He said, "I don't get it." I said, "Look, supposing this whole group were blind from birth, and I've been asked to give a lecture on the beauty of color, so I begin by saying, ladies and gentlemen, if I go too fast for you, raise your hand and ask me a question. Ladies and gentlemen, color is a manifestation of light. Up goes a hand. What is light?" I said, "You know what light is?" "No, sir." "Well, light is a radiation." "Like what?" "Well, it's part of the spectrum of energy." "You know what heat is?" "Yes." "Well, just as heat radiates warmth, so light makes things visible." Somebody raised their hand and says, "What is visible?" "Well," I said, "that means able to be seen." "Sorry, sir, we don't understand you." "Well," I said, "let me go on with my lecture. If you let a beam of light in the window and it strikes a prism of glass, the prism of glass will break it into a spectrum of color in the wall, like a rainbow." Up goes another hand. "What is a rainbow?" I give a definition from the textbook. They said, "Well, we've learned that too, but we don't know what it looks like." I said, "Well, it's red and blue and green." Up goes a hand. "What is green?" "Well," I said, "green is a secondary color." They said, "Well, what is it?" I said, "It's a mixture of yellow and blue." Up goes another hand. "What is blue?" I said, "Well, blue is a primary color." "Well, what's the characteristic of blue?" I said, "It's bluishness." Then a student says, "Sir, would it be possible to describe color in scientific language without this emotion?" I said, "What do you mean emotion?" "Well, feeling." "Oh," I said, "you're right, it's feeling all right. Just as a nerve in your leg conveys a sensation of pain to your brain, the optic nerve conveys a sensation of color. You're quite right, it's feeling." "Well, could you describe it without feeling?" I said, "Yes, there was a Swedish scientist, Angstrom, measured the wavelength of color. Red is 7,000 angstroms. Blue is 4,800 angstroms. Do you think all those blind students would nod and say, 'Thank you very much, sir, now we know what color is, and we don't have to depend upon this feeling like the hoi polloi out in the street. We've got a scientific definition'?" "Oh, no." I would say a poor old washerwoman with the blessing of eyesight knows more about color than a blind mathematician from Oxford or Harvard. Now, faith is an insight, a perception. The scripture says spiritual things are spiritually discerned. And one of the fallacies, I mentioned the fallacy of the soda in the various drinks. One of the fallacies that we find so often brought out is that science contradicts the idea of God. It is a fallacy. There is no fact of science and no generally accepted theory of science that contradicts the idea of God. I'll say that again. No fact of science and no generally accepted theory of science that contradicts the idea of God. Now, let's consider a little bit further. Why then do some intelligent people not believe in God? Well, I've heard it stated this way. Intelligent adults no longer believe in God for the same reason they no longer believe in Santa Claus. Why don't they any longer believe in Santa Claus? Well, simple reason that they can now explain the phenomena for which his existence was invoked. Why do atheists no longer believe in God? Because they can now explain the phenomena for which his existence was invoked? I would say emphatically, no. They can explain many of the phenomena which simple people invoked his existence for, but they still haven't given us the answer to the ultimate questions. Science of necessity is agnostic. If I said God is in this room, there isn't any empirical test for it. Would you use litmus paper? Or a Geiger counter? Or a spectrograph? There's no empirical test. and we still have some big questions to answer. It's either a matter of speculation. Why do intelligent adults no longer believe in Santa Claus? Well, simply because no intelligent adult even bothers to affirm the existence of Santa Claus, except imbeciles and morons. But why do atheists no longer believe in God? Because no intelligent adult affirms the existence of God? Quite the contrary. Many intelligent adults affirm the existence of God. Now, I know that it's popular today to discredit the teleological and the cosmological arguments for God. I'd like to say that I must make my position clear. I do not believe that the fact of God is established by argumentation. The Christian view is the opposite. It says it is by faith we understand the worlds were framed by the Word of God. And in my view, faith is a binary choice. Those of you who are not mathematicians, let me explain. For instance, take the 23-degree angle of the earth, very convenient for human life. Only two possible explanations. One is providence, the other is chance. Take, for instance, the fact that water expands when it freezes. Very convenient for human life. If it didn't, it would be impossible to live here. Only two possible explanations, providence or chance. And I could go right down the line. Now, I have a friend in Los Altos in California who works for IBM. He is paid a fabulous salary to think. His IQ is 208. I understand Einstein's was 209. His name is Gerhard Dirks. His English is still German English. But I was talking to him about some very interesting things when he said to me, "Or, what do you know about automation?" Well, I said, "Just a layman's knowledge." I said, "My wife has got a dishwashing machine, and she can tell whether it's sudsing or rinsing by the sound of the machine." But I said, "I opened it up, and I found a little wheel that made it do these things." Well, he said, "You know the meaning of the computer's language, bits of information? That bits of information must be put into a machine. Now, Ori," said, "you can design an automated plow to save a man's labor." He said, "That plow will go right across the field if you have directional finding equipment and a little motor and a blade that will roll over and raise. But," he said, "not much good if you have to send a man around the field to turn it around. So you design a turning device." But he said, "it takes more bits of information," and he said, "it's worked on that binary principle. It's a very multiplied thing." Well, he said, "now you've got a plow that runs back and forth, but it hits a rock. You can't, shall I say, send a man after to dig out rocks, so you design a rock ejector." He said, "that can be done. You have to throw in a clutch and spin the machine and lift the blade, put in the ejector, eject the rock, and then you go on across the field." But he said, "it hits a root. You can't eject a root, so you design a root cutter." But he said, "you understand, the more sophisticated the machine, the more the bits of information." Well, he said, "you know that we can build a computer to play checkers, drafts we would call them, to play checkers." He said, "that can be done. It's very expensive." But he said, "we have not yet attempted to build a computer to play chess. It would cost more than sending a man to the moon." But he said, "what then is the most highly developed machine?" "Well, the human brain can play chess." I began to think of the human machine and trying to work out the mathematical probability or the bits of information. For example, at the point of conception, a single cell receives a code. We call it the DNA genetic code. That tells it to divide in two and to multiply. It becomes a mass of cells. Some of the cells are told to become as hard as wood and they become like bone. Others are told to become nerves. They become a telegraph system. If I take a pin and stick it in your leg, a nerve in your leg sends a telegram to your brain saying, "Murphy, you've been stabbed." And that happens like that. That's just like the Western Union system, which, of course, also follows a pattern, shall we call it. What about the eyes? Certain cells are told to cluster together and form a television camera and convey electrical impressions to the brain. And you're watching me with those television cameras right now. He said, this goes on until the child is born. And even some of the instructions given at the point of conception decide when, for instance, the fellow's hair will fall out when he's 35 or whatever it may be. He said, "I try to work it out." He said, "or, it's fantastic." Now, he said, "I had to make a choice between chance and providence. I chose providence." He said, "I am a Christian." Now, you can get around this by simplifying. For instance, some people may say, well, if there's a stalactite hanging from the ceiling and drips of water come from it, it'll naturally form a stalagmite. And you don't need to explain that further. But that only is a simplification. In other words, the more sophisticated the machine, the higher the intelligence we look for to explain it. I was walking along a beach in Queensland, in Australia, when I saw a puddle of water, just the shape of Australia. It even had a little puddle for Tasmania. Now, I thought, well, that didn't happen by chance. But then, of course, the tide could have gone out and left a puddle. But I walked 10 yards further along and found another puddle. And then another one, right along. 14 of them in a row. I didn't know the explanation, but I refused to believe that it happened by chance or that enterprising crabs had done it. I found a little Australian boy playing with bucket and spade, nobody to play with, so this is what he did. Now, recently at Illinois State University, Northern Illinois University, a student came to me and said, "Just a moment, sir. Here's my chemistry textbook. Just a moment. Read this." I said, "I'll quote it for you. Professor Stanley Miller and Professor Harold Urey passed a bolt of electricity through some primeval gases, ammonium, methane, and the like, and got amino acids." Yes. "And amino acids are the building blocks of proteins." Yes. "And proteins are the building blocks of life." Yes. "Therefore, life could have begun by chance." "Do you think that's an argument for chance?" He said, "Yes, sir." "Do you think Stanley Miller was a fool?" "No, sir. He's a brilliant scientist. I've looked him up." I said, "Yes, he's a brilliant scientist, and he got recognition for this. And scientists are working night and day in the lab to try and duplicate the processes of life. They're not inventing them. They're discovering them." You say, "Well, you think they will produce life?" My dear friends, I know two PhDs near UCLA who have produced a baby. It has now lived 11 months. They feed it with certain formula. I should explain that one of the PhDs has a beard and the other's a cute little blonde. But let me say this. All they did in a very human way was to use the processes of life, and that's all the scientists are doing too. Friends, if you're going to make a case for chance out of passing electricity through primeval gases to get amino acids which were needed then, let me tell you that in a thunderstorm in Indiana in the summertime, the passage of lightning through our atmosphere produces fertilizers for the field. And I think that's a good argument for the purpose of the universe. Again, you can take your choice, chance or providence. I'm glad, of course, that the lightning today produces nitrogen compounds for us. Well, you see, as far as this is concerned, we can talk a lot about teleology. I would like to quote the poet Dryden. "This is a piece too fair to be the child of chance and not of care. No atoms casually together hurled could e'er produce so beautiful a world." What about cosmology? Another weak point, they say. The main attack on cosmology is that there never was a beginning. Now, of course, it depends on definitions. If you say the universe contains God, then, of course, you're under obligation to explain the origin of God. Like the little girl says, "Well, who made God?" Or I've heard even a Rotary member ask me that. You see, I began with the definition that God is the only infinite, eternal, and unchangeable spirit. That's an improper question, like ask me, "Have you stopped beating your wife?" Now, as far as this is concerned, you take, for instance, the scriptural statement, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth was without form and void and darkness in the face of the deep," and compare it with the latest article on cosmogony in the Encyclopedia Britannica, signed by George Gamow. I'm quoting, "Cosmogonists using the new values," that's Einstein's theory of relativity, "of measuring..." Involving this, "measuring the distance between galaxies," involving the Doppler effect and so forth, "have obtained an estimated 5 billion years total as the age of the universe," I'm quoting George Gamow now, "which is in perfect agreement with other astrophysical and geological calculations." Now, this is the observable universe. If you take a philosophical universe, well, I'm a little out of my depth there. In the beginning, God created. Science says nothing about God, but it does suggest a creation. And the ones that are cited here are Enrico Fermi and George Gamow and Einstein and Sir James Jeans. He's dead now, of course. But they end up with Gerhard Kuiper, who showed the moonshots on television recently. And he certainly holds this view. You say, what about the steady state cosmology? Well, let me quote George McVitie, University of Illinois, famous cosmologist. He said, "Observation suggests that the opposite is the case. Moreover, there is no experimental evidence to show that the postulated creation of matter is in fact taking place. Thus, the theory must at present be treated with reserve as being less compatible with observation than is Einstein's." And George Gamow says, thus, observational evidence in the early 1960s seemed to support the first set of theoretical conclusions. That's the Big Bang theory, and to contradict the second. Also, you've got a problem of reconciling the second law of thermodynamics. Not all of us here are physicists. I certainly am not. I try to keep up with my reading, though. I was asked to explain to a group of girls the other day what we meant by the first and second law of thermodynamics. I put it in simple language from my army days. It's like in gambling, you never get something for nothing. And second, you never even break even. That's the first and second laws of thermodynamics. Now, I asked a physicist just recently at University of Minnesota, what's the latest word? He said, well, California Institute of Technology, Richard Feynman. He said, are the laws of physics reversible? Evidently not. Just try to unscramble an egg. Then he says, it cannot be completely understood until the mystery of the beginnings of the history of the universe are reduced still further from speculation to scientific understanding. You notice I made a bold statement that not a single fact or accepted theory of science contradicts the idea of God. Today I went to the bookstore to look up your standard text on biology, Paul B. Weiss, Elements of Biology. He said, in actuality, the idea of evolution is not any more or any less anti-religious than the idea of special creation, for neither really strengthens, weakens, or otherwise affects belief in God. To the religious person, only the way God operates, not God as such, is in question. And again, it's just a matter of a choice. Now, I did say that the Christian faith is based on a divine revelation. Is that revelation trustworthy? Well, when I was in college 30 years ago, they told me the Gospel of John was written 300 years after Christ. Today, we can laugh at that. William Albright, brought up in the liberal tradition, Johns Hopkins University, our leading archaeologist, says he satisfied the documents were produced by 85 A.D., therefore in the lifetime of the apostles. That's the trend today. I would say historically is a good case. That's my field, history. I'm not a philosopher. I'm not a physicist. But I say there's a good case for these documents. What is credibility? Well, it says clear and convincing evidence. The only clear and convincing evidence of the existence of God is spiritual and might be ruled out by someone who wants to rule that out. By a preponderance of the evidence, that it's more probable than not, or beyond reasonable doubt, I will say it is impossible scientifically to discredit the idea of God. What about the character of the witnesses? Well, the person must be a witness of the facts. He must have a mental capacity. He must have moral character for veracity. And he must be consistent in his statements and conduct. I think the New Testament makes that statement. Meets that condition. Well, I'd like to sum up. It's in a nutshell. The revelation of God that is culminated in the good news of Jesus Christ is attested historically by its careful examiners and supported morally by its faithful advocates. I wish there were time to tell of its impact. This revelation meets in the highest degree the intuition or the awareness of deity found in all races, classes, sorts, and conditions of men. This revelation is wholly congenial with the established facts of science and provides the better explanation of the origin, order, utility, and end of the observable universe and of life included. That this revelation of God applied to the life of individuals, families, communities, nations, and races has promoted their highest good. I'm not speaking of the Inquisition, which to my mind was not related to the New Testament or to any other such thing. That this revelation is apprehended only by a spiritual perception, commonly called faith, which, humanly speaking, is a binary choice, one choice and two. Therefore, as the scripture says, God compels no man's faith. He simply gives you a choice. And those of us who enter into this and accept it by the spiritual perception find it enriches our lives enormously. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
you, Dr. Orr. Now, Dr. Scriven.
If I may, I'll speak from here. It's my question.
It might save toting the apparatus around a little bit if I spoke from there. I hope you will forgive me for the fact that what I have to say will be relatively less well-ordered and I'm afraid a great deal less entertaining, because I'm trying to speak to what Dr. Orr said, and what he said tonight in a way in which I had not previously seen it. So these are just by way of being comments on his remarks. Whenever a debate of this kind takes place, in my experience, there is always a great deal of nervousness amongst people who see it coming up. And this debate was no exception. There were anxious telephone calls from ministers around this area who were worried by the fact that, on the one hand, Dr. Orr was going to be taken as representing them, and on the other hand, by the fact that I was going to be taken as representing some unknown but presumably evil spirits. The problem is, of course, that if you are nervous about your own position in these matters, you will take every opportunity that you can to see the speakers as not really defending the view that you have. And so, of course, it will be undoubtedly the case that a number of you will feel that Christianity could have got a better deal than Dr. Orr gives it, and the devil could have got his due in a more efficient way than by me. The situation in this respect was simplified considerably by Dr. Ramsey in his column in the Bloomington Herald Telephone earlier this week, in which he announced the discussion as being around the topic, the non-existence of God, and put in parentheses after Dr. Orr's name the statement that Dr. Orr would be speaking for God. It's not entirely clear to me whether this was a revelation on the behalf of Dr. Ramsey or simply the announcement of one by Dr. Orr. But in any event, it made me feel a little outnumbered. Well, I'm afraid that's going to be the last vaguely funny remark I have. I want to take up a number of points. None of them will I be able to deal with thoroughly, but perhaps to indicate to you the response that I would want to make to the position that Dr. Orr has. In the first place, Dr. Orr has restricted, sensibly enough, the range of his debate to the what we might call the theistic element in Christianity, the conception of God as the Christian sees it, according to his definition of God. And I want to just begin by stressing what an enormously important difference that makes to the argument. A number of people thinking about this debate, and it's typical, in particular all the people who wrote to the Indiana Daily Student about it, immediately identified it as a debate between an atheist and a Christian. But that's not what it's about. It's, is Christianity credible? And there are a number of people around who don't think Christianity is at all credible, amongst them the Mahometans and the Jews. Christianity is essentially a doctrine about the relationship of Christ to God. It is certainly a doctrine which implies the existence of God, but its particular feature that makes a Christian rather than a Jew is the belief that Christ was the Son of God. Without going into the theology of this, it seems to me important to remind you at the beginning that the idea that Christ was more than a teacher is one which is not maintained by a very large proportion of the theists on this campus, and indeed in the Western tradition. It is explicitly denied. Within the last week, the local papers have happened to have carried reviews of two recent books, one of them called The Jews and Jesus, and another on Mahometanism. both of them explicitly making this point, a point which is constantly overlooked. The invention of the phrase Judeo-Christian makes people feel that in some sense they can be identified with respect to the doctrine that the Jewish tradition and the Christian tradition have. They can only be identified with respect to theism, not with respect to either morality, the specific details of morality, or with respect to the doctrine of the divinity of Christ. So this is not a debate about atheism against theism or against Christianity. It is a debate about the credibility of Christianity, and in that debate, the Jews and the Mohammedans, to mention only the Western religions, of course, argue against the Christian. Now, I want to make my position perfectly clear at the beginning. In terms of the definitions that Dr. Orr gave, I am simply an atheist. That is, I think there is no God. And I'm not an agnostic at all. An agnostic is in that awkward fence-sitting position, which requires an eternal effort to maintain balance, a balance which is extremely difficult to maintain. There are, of course, two types of agnostic. One is the person who says, I don't know, and that may be because he hasn't had the time or feels himself not capable to make a study of the arguments in both directions. But the affirmative or obnoxious type of agnostic is the one who says, I know that we don't know, and I know you can't know either. And he's more interesting to debate with, but I think on the whole has a more awkward position. At any rate, whatever his position or the basis for it, he has to come to terms eventually with a discussion of the kind that we are undertaking this evening. Dr. Orr and I, meeting as we do a very long way from our homelands in a foreign country, have, curiously enough, a number of things in common. One of these is that we happen to have got our doctorate at the same university. Another is that we have a certain degree of respect for taking these matters seriously enough to attempt to give arguments on both sides and study them. In the beginning of his most recent book, Dr. Orr has a quotation from 1 Peter, which I'll now read to you. Be always ready to give a logical reply to everyone who asks you for a reason of the hope you cherish within you. Be always ready to give a logical reply to everyone who asks you for a reason of the hope you cherish within you. And it's in the spirit of that quotation, which I like very much, that I propose to take up some of the things that he said in more detail. In the first place, the position of an evangelical Christian of Dr. Orr's general persuasion with respect to the role of argument is awkward. Whereas on the one hand he does feel, as that quotation indicates, the importance of giving reasons, on the other hand he feels, and to quote him, that the fact of God cannot be established by arguments. Now, what exactly is the role of the arguments, then, that he produces? Because arguments he does produce, and they are arguments of very great interest, and presented by him, I think, in an extremely interesting and up-to-date form. Are we to take them seriously or not? If they're not going to work, if we want to say in advance that this isn't the way in which you establish something, like God's existence, then why do we bother with them at all? The Roman Church, whose position on this is systematically, deliberately, and extraordinarily vague, is one has argued at times, out of one side of its mouth, that the actual position is that the arguments can prepare the way, that they can soften you up, though they don't actually use that phrase. That the final step is possible only if you are granted grace, and that grace is not in this instance granted as a reward, it is just issued by the inscrutable design of God himself. It follows from that, of course, and this I think is the best interpretation of the Roman Church's position on this, that one cannot argue that the arguments do prove God's existence. It follows from that, furthermore, that if an intelligent, rational person looks at them, he is not going to come to the conclusion that they work, and moreover, he cannot be blamed for not coming to the conclusion that they do work. And hence, if he is, in fact, an invincible atheist, he is not to be blamed for this, and consequently cannot be punished for it, and consequently must, of course, go to heaven. I've always... I I've always regarded that as a very valuable insurance policy for myself. Well, I want to take the argument seriously because I have a general view about the role of these arguments, which I'm going to indicate to you. It is the view that in the case of God, and in the case of a number of other entities of a very special kind, whose conception we understand, although the question of their existence is the one that we're interested in such cases, if the arguments fail, there is no possible alternative to atheism. Now, there are entities with respect to whose existence we might be in some doubt where that's not true at all, where if the arguments for the existence of the entity fail, you just must conclude that you don't know whether it exists or not. So one can't ever pull the general line that if the arguments don't work, it follows that you must, of course, deny the existence of the thing in question. If, for example, you don't believe that there are any green chrysanthemums because you've never seen any and you've never heard of any, then the arguments for their existence have failed as far as you're concerned, but you wouldn't want to go out and lay a large sum of money on the line to state that there were, in fact, no green chrysanthemums. You know, after all, that there are lots of green things and some green flowers, and as a matter of fact, it happens that a green chrysanthemum was developed last year. Now, so you would be wrong, but you know very well that you're not going to bet very heavily against its existence, simply because it's the kind of thing which isn't altogether improbable. If, on the other hand, we started discussing the existence of some entity which was perhaps very large in expanse but had negative weight and was also extremely intelligent but incapable of communication and a few other peculiar properties like that, then if somebody went around saying, well, I can't prove that it exists, but you really ought to suspend judgment about it, maybe it does, you'd view this with great disfavor. Your general attitude would normally be that you don't have any inclination whatsoever to suppose there is such a thing. You should not alter your plans in any way to take account of that possibility, and so on. The Santa Claus argument, in fact, bears a good deal more scrutiny than I think Dr. Orr gave it. It is true that adults treating, when they are dealing with other adults rather than with their own children, and Dr. Orr, I thought, was being perhaps a little unkind to people's children in saying that only imbeciles and morons are ever informed that there is a Santa Claus. Adults dealing with adults do not maintain there is a Santa Claus anymore. They do not indeed. But why do they not maintain there is a Santa Claus? The situation, after all, is that nobody has given a disproof of the existence of Santa Claus. Nobody has, and yet you don't believe he exists at all. None of you think he exists. None of you even think it's a serious likelihood, one that you should take account of at all, even though not overwhelmingly probable. The situation with respect to extraordinary entities of a kind not like other ones that we're familiar with, and Santa Claus is certainly in that category, and so far more so is God, defined as Dr. Orr does. He becomes the only being with infinite properties and so on. If we define God in that way, the stakes go up. The game becomes a dangerous game. The prize is enormous. If we can establish the existence of such a being, we have indeed established something of vast importance. But if we cannot give good arguments for the existence of such a being, then we must believe that there is not such a being. For else the world becomes peopled with an infinity of absurd beings flitting around in a ghostly way, none of them absolutely disproved, and none of them in the least likely, but suddenly you're committed to take them seriously because you're suddenly arguing that just because there isn't a disproof, it doesn't follow that you should doubt their existence. Disproof is not the point. The point with respect to extraordinary beings, unheralded in the previous experience of people, is that if you can't give a proof, then you must in fact not believe that such beings exist. You do not believe that there is beneath the seat in which you are now sitting a green crocodile, wholly invisible, but ready to snap at your feet. You do not believe that as you leave this room, the floor will fall away from beneath your feet. All of these things you know very well are possible. You have no proof available now against these possibilities, yet you absolutely and ruthlessly and rightly disregard them. You are an atheist about that crocodile. In exactly the same way, if the arguments for the existence of God fail, you must be an atheist about that being too. Now let's look at the arguments to which Dr. Orr made some appeal. And it should be clear, by the way, from what I've been saying, that I do, in fact, constantly refer to God, and I do, in fact, believe that there is such a concept. But, of course, thinking that there is such a concept and appealing to him in the course of ordinary conversation in the idiom that we use does not indicate that one has any belief in his existence. The question we're up against is not whether we think there's a concept of God, but whether, in fact, there is a God. Now, Dr. Orr really used three main arguments, which I'm going to speak about very briefly indeed. One is the argument from religious experience, which he described by saying that he thought that religious faith is a kind of insight analogous to a special sense, analogous in a way to vision. The second is the claim that the design that we see in the universe cannot be due to chance alone and must therefore be taken to be due to the activities of a designer. And the third was an argument centering around cosmological considerations and related to the question of whether or not there's a beginning to the universe. I take it it is of the form that science today thinks that there was a beginning to the universe. And then the question is, where did it come from? And to that, science does not provide an answer, and since it does not, we must turn elsewhere for an answer. Now, let me begin by making quite clear that I have no wish to maintain that science does contradict the idea of God. It doesn't at all. I believe Dr. Orr is absolutely right in saying there is no fact or generally believed theory of science which contradicts the idea of God. There is certainly no such belief. What contradicts the idea of God is not any particular science, which is not concerned with such matters, but the sum total of all the evidence that we have available to us through scientific and other means, applied using the logic of whatever domains are appropriate, including the arguments from analogy, which he himself favors, and arguments using probability inferences, and arguments using legal procedures, any kind of argument that can be demonstrated as being a kind which leads in ordinary applications to reliable conclusions. I have no wish to restrict the range of logic to scientific method. It is not so restricted by anything that I say. I argue using any tools that can be shown to work and extrapolate them into the domain where we wish to find the answer to an important question. Now, if we take up these arguments which he considered, I think I can state very quickly what it is that I think provides the main difficulty with them. It's not so easy to state a complete alternative theory, because it is perfectly clear that the doctrine of theism, the belief in the existence of God, offers us what is at first sight the most plausible account of some of the most pervasive, exciting, extraordinary, and peculiar aspects of our existence and our environment. And it provides us with answers to a large number of questions that burst instinctively from us and which demand an answer from us. The purpose of life, the meaning of life, the foundations of ethics, whether we are free, where we are going, will we die, do we die forever, where did we come from, where did the universe come from? All of these questions are questions which come to us as we turn in a reflective way on the nature and problems of our life and which demand an answer. It is, however, not the province of reason to always provide answers for questions which seem to demand an answer. It is the harder task of reason to sometimes demonstrate that the questions are themselves mistaken, that they are indeed questions of the kind that is involved, involving the kind of fallacy that is involved in the question, have you stopped beating your wife yet? Or in the question, what is the largest number? These are questions which begin by puzzling us at one stage in our thought. We often extrapolate questions that are entirely appropriate about any individual to a group. We begin to treat the state as if it was an organism itself. We begin to look for the analogy, the analogous elements in it, to the head, to the heart, to the nerves, and so on. Much of political philosophy has been devoted to the attempt to undo the evils of that analogy. In the same way, the attempt to find that from which the whole universe came commits precisely that fallacy. It cannot be answered because it is not a proper question. It appeals to us. But it is easy to demonstrate that it cannot be answered. It takes a very long time to get to the point where you begin to realize that you can still think and think sensibly and not be evading a question in seeing that that question has, in fact, can have no answer. Why is it easy to see that it can have no answer? By looking at the answers that are proposed. How can the supposition be made that the universe, supposing that it had a beginning in time, came from God? How could that possibly be thought to be an answer? It is an answer which is produced by the insistence that there must always be an answer to the question, where did this come from? And yet, it is an answer which forbids the asking of that question. If you insist that there must always be an answer to the question, from whence did something come, then you must answer the question, from whence did God come? And if you answer that in terms of another God, the question will be asked again. That answer cannot possibly work because it contains the seeds of its own destruction. It is a buck-passing answer. Let us answer a mystery by inventing another mystery to provide the answer. The same mystery, but with a different name. The first mystery is where the universe came from. We answer it. It came from something else. But now we give that a name, which means that it's not legitimate to ask the question anymore. But if you're going to stop asking that question at some stage, if you wish to argue, for example, that God isn't the kind of thing which comes from anywhere, what makes you think the universe is? What made you take that extra step? You think that it must be possible because the universe is, after all, just material, and all material things have an origin? But each one of you has, in fact, got a father, and yet there isn't a father for the whole audience. Each number has a larger number beyond it, and yet there isn't the largest number. Each material object in the universe can have a beginning, and yet the universe as a whole may not have a beginning, as the steady state theory maintains. And more important and crucial to this issue, each object in the universe may have come from other objects in the universe at an earlier time, and yet it may be the case that the universe as a whole did not come from another object. Not only may it be the case, but there is no alternative to it. The alternatives are empty. They deceive you. You apply the word God, and you think that then you have answered a question. You have not. You have raised a question, the same question. So therefore, you have not answered the question. As a kind of footnote to the discussion about the origin of the universe, it's perfectly true that at the moment the steady state theory isn't looking very good. But then, of course, the steady state theory isn't the only theory that involves infinite age for the universe. The universe may perfectly well be infinitely old in spite of the Big Bang theory. Gamow, in his book, The Origin of the Universe, writes to this effect. I was extremely annoyed by that book because I was interested in the question of where the universe came from, and he goes on and on for 200 pages about what it's been doing lately, and then... in an appendix, he thinks it might be appropriate to raise the question of what happened before the Big Bang, and then he mentions the fact that it might, of course, have been the case that the universe was contracting before the Big Bang, so that we're now in an expansion phase. And perhaps, he says, it may have gone through an infinite cycle of expansions and contractions. So the Gamow approach, of course, doesn't give us any grounds for thinking that there was an origin, but I don't mind in the least whether we think it was infinitely old or not, any more than St. Augustine minded when he invented the argument which relates to this point, St. Thomas, rather. Now, moving to the other argument, which I'm going to finish off with, although I'll say something about the argument from faith. The probability argument, the argument from design, is an interesting one. Professor Dr. Orr has presented this in a form in which it is open to an attack which I shall have to make, though I think he will, in fact, have another move he wants to make in reply to this. He's presented it... in terms of the only two possible alternatives being chance or providence. And he then goes on to point out the extraordinary complexity of man's own nature and the world in which we live. And he does this in terms of the remarks about the information content or the information processing capacity of the computer that would be designed to plow a field. However, the initial dilemma is not legitimate. There are not just two alternatives, chance or providence, and man did not come about either through chance or through providence. We are not the way we are as a result of chance, nor as a result of providence. We are the way we are as a result of a combination of a very large number of physical laws, plus the extremely long-run activities of a process which is partly chance-governed. Let me give you an example which will perhaps impinge upon your thinking more directly than the abstract point. It is not by chance alone that the hotels at Las Vegas tend to win on the roulette wheel. And yet the process is a fully chance process. In exactly the same way, it is not by chance alone that an intelligent, organized, teleological being emerges as the result of the evolutionary process. Nevertheless, the fundamental activity that goes into the mutation process from which new species spring is essentially chance. The raw material is provided by chance, but it is filtered out by the action of the survival of the fittest doctrine. And at the end, we find something around which is rather well adapted to handling its environment, for the rather dull reason that if it wasn't, it wouldn't be here. One can't get mystery and wonder into the story of evolution unless you begin with a hidden premise of a particularly unattractive kind, namely the hidden premise that somehow it was all set up to come out with you. Now, if you think that it was, if you assume that it was at the beginning, then indeed it is remarkable that it did. There were a lot of opportunities for alternatives along the route. However, if you think of it the other way, in terms of a naturalistic account, the story is indeed a great deal simpler. It may be thought of simply in this way. At every turn of the wheel of fortune, there was a chance that something would evolve that would survive, and there was a chance that something would evolve that wouldn't survive. Since we're here, something evolved which did survive. But it might very well have been the other way. It happens to have been this way. We are what we are, the product of those eons of chance and absence of planning. We are now in a position where we are able to share the responsibility with the waves from outer space which impinged upon the germplasm of our ancestors and produced us. We're now able to say proudly that it is our fault that the world's as bad as it is. So planning has entered, but at a rather later stage and with rather less attractive results. Now, that's the alternative that I would want to present. It is simply to say that the explanation is not pure chance. Indeed, that would be an absurd one. And it is not pure providence. Indeed, that would be an unnecessary one. It is a combination of the two. Finally, I want to add a word about the argument from faith or religious experience. Dr. Orr has, I think, picked immediately upon the best possible way of presenting this argument, the analogy with the individual with a sense that his fellows lack. How can the blind man argue that there is no sense of sight? He simply lacks it. It is extremely important in thinking in terms of that analogy to realize that the man with sight can do things that the man who is blind can immediately recognize absolutely require another sense. It is not simply the case that the blind man cannot see. The blind man cannot see, and the blind man falls over the stool in the middle of the room, which the man with sight always avoids. And the blind man can see, in the metaphorical sense, that in fact his friend never falls over it. So he knows that his friend has access to knowledge of a kind that he does not have. And so on in 100 ways. It is quite true that the blind man does not have something which the sighted man has. But he can show this, and the sighted man can prove to him that he has that avenue to knowledge. In the case of revelation, we totally lack that independent grounds, that independent evidence that the man who claims to have the religious sense in fact is in touch with reality. There is no way in which you can distinguish him from the man who believes himself to be in touch with a higher order of reality, but in fact is mistaken in that. This is not to impugn the word of somebody who believes they have had religious experiences. They have, of course, had religious experiences in the neutral sense of that term. But if you wish to argue that they have, in fact, been in touch with a divine being, and that they should be entitled, as a result of this, to believe in God. I'm not arguing about the question of whether we should believe them. I'm arguing about whether they should believe that there is a God on the basis of that experience which they think is an experience of God. They should not. The argument is no better for them than for us. It won't do to argue, as the Protestant tends to today, that religion is a personal affair. Some of us have had the experience which makes it valid for us, and others have not. You have not had the experience that makes it valid for you unless you had that experience through a sense of some kind, perhaps the 7th, 10th, or 30th sense. I have no intention to restrict the senses to the 5, the most familiar. But you must have grounds for supposing that that extra sense does give you the truth. Now, those grounds cannot come from the consensus of agreement amongst the religious community. It is not important that people agree. Agreement may be due to bias. What is important is the question of whether it leads you to truths, which you can independently test in a way that does not involve a circular argument, which does not involve saying, I see through my religious experience that such and such is the right way, and consequently, I test this by finding out that if I take this way, I find things are better. That may simply show that belief in God is good for you. And it may be that belief in God is good for some people, and it's quite clear that it's bad for others. The question that's important is whether it's true. And to show that it's true, you have got to do something quaint and old-fashioned, like stretching out the sheepskins on the mountaintop and finding that, in fact, the prophet of the Lord's sheepskin turns up with the dew and not the prophet of Baal's. Or that you blow the trumpet 3 times and the walls fall down. Or that you predict that something terrible is going to happen to the cities of the plain, and it does. There's something sort of quaint about those stories, and we think of ourselves as being very sophisticated because we've moved beyond them. But unfortunately, in moving beyond them, we have moved beyond the realm in which it is possible to give the evidence which would make sense of this story. Faith is not an extra sense until it is demonstrated, not by the crudities of litmus paper, but by the straightforward procedures which a common sense approach requires, by showing that there is in fact something there which is not present to the man who deluded believes himself to be in touch with, or indeed to be Christ. Let me finish off by saying this. If there is a God, he gave us our reason. To ignore it is a crime against his name. It is to flout something which he designed and gave us if he exists. There can be no alternative to the use of reason in these matters. The suggestion that faith is in some way an alternative is the suggestion that there should be no rules of thought, that you should in fact cast your lot blindly and by chance without thought and foresight. You do not do that in any domain of practical life, whether it is inspired by belief in the Lord or not. One cannot conceive why you should imagine that with respect to that belief in the Lord, you should then abandon all the rules. So the approach through reason is the only one. Now, if it is the only one, the question arises, what happens if we cannot give reasons for the existence of God? We may then do one of two things. We may say, I believe, although I have no reasons, just because that is of the stuff of which I am made, I find I can do no other. If one does that, then one concedes a weakness in oneself. That is nothing to be ashamed of. We all have them. But it is a weakness. It is a proof that you cannot live up to the standards which clearly work in every realm of your life except this. And it is an admission that in this particular area, you have to turn to others for your beliefs, or turn to some avenue for which there can be no guarantee of truth. If you say, I have arguments. There is no way to explain the way the world is or make sense of morality or the existence of man except in this way. Then you are saying that you can establish God's existence as the most plausible explanation. And if you're going to take that route, it lies over hard and stony ground. You must show that the alternative explanations which do not involve this monstrous hypothesis, this enormously complicated supreme being, you must show that those other alternatives are untenable. Today, in this age, Dr. Orr speaks rightly when he, I think, summarizes the views of the leading theologians, Protestant and even Catholic, when he says that these arguments do not establish the existence of God. And in the absence of arguments that do establish that existence, we must then believe that there is, in fact, no God, as indeed there is, in fact, no Santa Claus. Thank you. Now have a 10-minute period in which the speakers will discuss between themselves the issues raised. I'm sure Dr. Orr would have a question ready for Dr. Scriven.
Wasn't he first?
Is your microphone on, Dr. Scriven?
Dr. Scriven, he was to go first.
Would you like to ask the first question? Or?
No. I wonder if we could come to one interesting point, that is, when I made a statement about faith being a binary choice between chance and providence, I would be very happy in future to state between providence and a combination of chance and law, if that would meet what you were trying to say. But of course, on the other hand, I believe that a supreme intelligence who meets the definition of God that's revealed for us would, of course, know the outcome of the roulette wheel of probability. For instance, there's a case given in Feynman's lectures on physics about shaking up a globe full of black and white balls and illustrating the law of entropy that they become completely confused. But if you take a movie film and show the film backwards, you could show them all jumping back into place. Well, now, I feel that the divine intelligence in which we believe, of course, knows the outcome of probability, knows the outcome of law, knows the outcome of everything, therefore doesn't invalidate what I've said. But I want to ask this question about the title. You did begin by mentioning Jewish and Muslim ideas of God. For my satisfaction, could you tell me, or if we don't know, could someone in the audience tell me, if Jews and Muslims, I'm speaking of Orthodox Jews and Muslims, or historic Jews and Muslims, would accept the definition that God is the only infinite, eternal, and unchangeable spirit, the being in whom all things begin, continue, and end? Wouldn't you say that's their definition also, more or less?
I'm prepared to accept that it is. I mean, yes. I wasn't denying that.
No, thank you very much.
But I was arguing that there are two aspects to Christianity. One is that version of theism, and the other is the divinity of Jesus Christ.
Yes. Well, of course, I'd be happy to discuss the divinity of Jesus Christ on another occasion, as you understand. It would take more than the time we have. Now, I noticed that you returned to the illustration of Santa Claus. In Ireland, there's supposed to be leprechauns. I've never seen any. You said that nobody could disprove the existence of Santa Claus, but yet nobody believes in him. But I would say this, if we sent out a circular letter to every adult in the United States and said, can you explain the phenomena of Santa Claus associated with your house? They would reply, I'm Santa Claus. I dressed up to entertain my children. That is an alternative, isn't it?
It is an alternative to what? Yeah.
It's an alternative to believing in the existence of Santa Claus. To believe that your father was Santa Claus.
That's just to believe in the existence of Santa Claus and to believe that it's your father.
Yes, well, in other words, it explains the supernatural aspects of Santa Claus away. Therefore, there is proof against him, really.
Oh, if you think that giving a naturalistic explanation of the phenomena is proof against, then of course you're in trouble with the existence of God, because then you're up against the naturalistic alternatives to the arguments for God.
No, you see, that because I don't accept your very basic point that, you see, you agreed with me that science, no fact of science, no generally accepted theory of science contradicts the idea of God, I would say that science could investigate Santa Claus.
Well, science can... I mean, if you mean that we could invent a new science, which is called Santa Clausology, and start in...
Yes.
Then
yes.
There's certainly nothing impossible about that, and there's a corresponding alternative, which is naturalistic theology. We start that, and we find exactly the same situation in parts. This would involve combining the results of evolutionary theory with those of cosmology and various other things.
Well, I must say that I have appreciated your statement of the case that, as I say, forms the other side of this whole discussion. And I simply would return to my own statement that faith in God is the alternative to believing that it's a haphazard origin of the universe. That's certainly true. But may I quote Feynman, whom I mentioned before? He says that the universe is not a fluctuation, that the law of entropy, which is more widely accepted than the law of gravitation, more generally accepted, shows that it's not a fluctuation, but it's a steadily declining entity.
Yeah, I think things are going downhill.
Yes.
But they're not about to... that doesn't mean they're about to vanish, though. I mean, what can you make of the fact that entropy is increasing? This doesn't lead to the conclusion that the universe will disappear, and we can't work backwards to the argument that it must have appeared. Things could be going downhill for an infinitely long time without ever having had a start. Just have a curve which is asymptotic to the x-axis.
Of course, we just come back to the statement again that the law of entropy certainly does not contradict the idea of God either.
It certainly does not.
One other remark, you said about a blind man can notice the reactions of a seeing man, that he doesn't stumble over the chair and so forth. Don't you think that an unbelieving man can notice the effect of faith in God in the life of a believing man?
Absolutely, and that's why I think that if we were arguing about the question of whether faith can do good things, then we'd be arguing an empirical question, and a case could be made for the claim that faith in God does do good things for men's lives. But of course we're not arguing about that question, but about whether that faith is true.
Of course I believe it's true, and I believe it's true in the sense that it's revealed to us as truth, and it's not contradicted by either science or any accepted view of science.
But everything is now packed into the word revealed to us as true. The
yes.
question is whether it's revealed to us as true or whether we just believe it's true.
Again, that would take me back to my point of making a choice.
Yes, I think we've got a choice to make, all right, but I think that the dice are loaded.
Well, one other thing I was going to mention. You mentioned something about the arguments of the Thomists in the Roman Catholic Church and so forth. I'm not here as a spokesman for my Roman Catholic friends, but I'd like to make my point clear and see if you appreciate it. I don't think we who are Christians, build our case on the four commonly accepted arguments for God, the teleological, cosmological, anthropological, and ontological. There are others, of course, but I mentioned the four commonly accepted ones. I saw a man making something out of wood. I said, "What are you making?" He said, "Something to sit on." I said, "Those are legs." I said facetiously, "Are you going to sit on the legs?" He said, "Don't be silly. These fit into a seat. I sit on the seat." Well, you see, the Christian begins with a seat on which he sits. That is a revelation by the Supreme Being to him. And these arguments simply show that it's not uncongenial to reason. Therefore, I don't regard them as a proof, and I don't think we ever could make them a proof, although I do know that some of my friends do think they can prove that God is a rational imperative. I would say he's a rational choice.
You see, we can't go from the fact that belief in God is not contradicted by any facts of science to the conclusion that it is congenial to reason. That requires a further proof, namely that no combination of all the facts of science and other facts of our knowledge and other forms of logic besides mere scientific method can give us an alternative account of those phenomena which are alleged to be explicable only in terms of God's existence. If by combining all that we know in that way, we can give an alternative account which requires no special hypothesis at all, then the individual who wishes to argue that there is a God must produce extra evidence for that conclusion. And revelation, of course, is not evidence until it's shown to be revelation. And showing that it's revelation simply requires that you demonstrate that it leads you to truths you can't get another way. And that's what's hard to prove.
Pardon me, we've reached a halfway point now, a little past the halfway point. Dr. Scriven, do you have some questions?
No, I talked too long anyway, and it seems to me that I was shooting away at Dr. Orr, and so he should have the chance to raise the questions of me. So we'll share our time, and when he feels he's raised the questions he wants to raise, then I think we could turn it over to the audience.
Well, perhaps I could say, Mr. Moderator, that I think Dr. Scriven has presented his side so well, and I've tried to show my side that it's a choice between providence and haphazard chance mixed with law, or whatever the definition may be, that I'd let it rest there and take the questions from the audience.
All right, thank you. I am very impressed with the seriousness with which these two gentlemen attack this question. I hope that those of you who have questions from the audience will take the same serious attack and ask questions that are answerable as far as possible, and questions that are concise and repeatable as far as possible, because I'm going to try to repeat them. One right here.
I wondered if Dr. Scriven could elucidate a little more on this. Proof that there is no God from the argument of law.
The argument of what?
Evil.
Get the question up?
The question is, would I expound on my proof that there is no God from the problem of evil, which I've not raised tonight. It's quite true that I have two grounds for my atheist views. One is the failure of the arguments and the general reasons which I've given for thinking that in the case of unprecedented beings, that constitutes grounds for disbelief in their existence. The second is more direct. The second is a simple claim, at the moment known to have been formulated in its neatest form 2,400 years ago. It is the claim that there is no way in which the hypothesis of a benevolent, omnipotent, or even extremely powerful being can be reconciled with the existence of evil in the world. Now, the being which Dr. Orr is talking about did not explicitly include benevolence. He defined God as the only infinite, eternal, and unchangeable spirit, the being in whom all beings have their being. But I suspect he'd want to argue that, in fact, goodness is part of that in some way. Now, the first thing to be said in discussing all arguments of the existence of God, pro and con, is that they're tough. Father Joyce, a Jesuit, writing about the problem of evil, said that he, in his judgment, this was the most difficult problem that the mind of man has ever faced and has attempted to deal with for as long a period as this has been around. I cannot give you a short way of handling the many moves and countermoves that have been made in trying to explain evil as consistent with the existence of a divine good being. I will very briefly indicate two of these in just a couple of minutes. The one argument that is normally produced is the claim that, as a matter of fact, the evil comes from man and not from God, that God gave us free will, and we then, of our own free will, do evil. This is a necessary consequence of the decision to make us free. In the first place, it isn't, and in the second place, even if it was, that wouldn't salvage the argument. It isn't a necessary consequence of the decision to make us free because the angels are free or else they wouldn't be virtuous, and yet they're obviously rather better than us. Or if you want the saints rather than the angels as being beings that did exist, then it's quite clear that saints or even just saintly people are very much better than us but still free. and therefore it was possible for God to make man such that he was in fact very much better than he is and still free. So freedom does not imply the necessity for evil. In the second place, even if it did, it would not salvage the concept of a divine benevolent being. Supposing that you have a child of a particularly wicked turn of mind, and that on one particular sunny afternoon, you discover him attempting to shorten the length of his sister's legs by using the rotary lawnmower. Entranced by this sight, you stand by, and when asked why you didn't do something to prevent it, you say that he is in fact a free agent, and hence, of course, it is his responsibility that this should have occurred. Now, it's quite clear that it is his responsibility in one important sense. Let's assume that he's old enough to know what he's doing, in the same way that we are. It does not follow at all that it's not your responsibility. If you are capable of preventing evil and do not do so, you are in fact yourself wicked. God may indeed have made us free and capable of doing evil, and then we do indeed have the responsibility for it, but so does he, because he could prevent it. Now, it's sometimes argued at that stage that if he prevented it, he would destroy the conception of good and evil in it. It would so to speak, leave us without a real capacity for doing evil. Not at all. A policeman who, in fact, prevents a homicide does not constitute a ground for preventing us from sentencing the man for attempted homicide. There is no difficulty in distinguishing evil intentions and attempted evil actions from attempted good actions. In those terms alone, we would be subject to exactly the same kind of rewards and punishments that God is supposed to award to us now. So that move won't do. And so on. The suggestion is made that unless there is both good and evil, then we couldn't have the conception of good and evil. And consequently, we wouldn't know what we were choosing between. That won't do any more than the argument that a good mathematician who doesn't make mistakes in addition doesn't have the conception of a mistake. Of course he does. You don't have to make mistakes to know that a mistake is a result which gives you a wrong answer. And so on. Those are some of the moves in the involved strategic debates between the pro-argument from evil and those who oppose it.
Would you like to reply to that?
Just to say this, that it would take quite a lengthy time to discuss this. I'd be glad to discuss it in great detail in, say, some session later. But I would like to comment on one thing. Dr. Scriven said, quoting the angels, they're free and yet they're not produced evil. The Christian view, and also the Jewish view, I think also the Muslim view, is that evil began with the angels, not with man. And that also, furthermore, I take it you've read in the Hebrew scriptures of an angel called Lucifer. He's not angelic in our sense of the word, so that that would invalidate that idea, although it doesn't invalidate what you've just put forth as an argument. I'd much rather discuss this argument at greater length. But I will say this, that the Christian revelation teaches that the law of God should be adopted by individuals as well as nations, and that takes care of the problem of evil. The trouble is that man, while he is still free, chooses to disobey it. For instance, I think that the problems we have in part of the United States today are due to the fact that men are lawless, and they will not allow, for instance, in the case of the United States, the details of the Constitution to be carried into effect. And that's lawlessness. But I must concede to you right away that there's something of a mystery about evil, and it would take a much longer discussion than now. It was brought up by this gentleman, but I really wish we had a couple of hours to discuss it.
Question right here.
Let's take it one at a time.
The question simply is not your point on the oversimplification on not being able to ask a question, who created God?
I'm not sure whether the speaker's going to be quite clear that that was his question, but then I'm not quite clear what his question was either, so I'll just try at one thing that I think was in it. You have a definitional error in there, which completely invalidates the point anyway, but you also have another kind of error in it, which is more interesting. I'll say something about both. The definitional error is the assertion that something which is infinite has nothing outside it. Of course, it's quite obvious that in ordinary two-dimensional space, there are double infinities. There are infinities along each axis. You can have an infinite number of infinite numbers of infinite numbers of sets. There are plenty of infinities which have lots of things outside them. Infinities, in fact, are all around the Euclidean plane, and they are enclosed in every circle with unit radius in the Euclidean plane, each of which has an infinite number of things outside it. In fact, an infinity of infinities outside it. So that isn't really very promising. Second... Well, that sort of applause reminds me of the fact that in Indiana everybody applauds ballet dancers that do six pirouettes, which is one of the easiest things to do on the stage, and they never applaud the hard stuff. So, the point that you were after, though, which comes closer to the, I think, the worry that was really bothering you, is the question of the illegitimacy of raising the question about where God comes from. Now, it doesn't have to hinge on your point about infinity. It might be that you just argue that God is, in fact, a different kind of being, and is a kind of being whose existence comes into existence because of his nature, and not because of something outside it. Put it this way, your first way of putting the point is perfectly sound. It is this: might there not be beings whose existence is not due to the existence of some external object, but simply goes along with their nature? The might, indeed, at least it seems logically possible that the might, and the problem for you is then to show that the universe isn't one of those things. And until you can show that, you can't possibly justify bringing in God, whether he is or not of that kind. Since you've admitted that some beings do not need an external cause, then you have got to show that the universe is not one of those beings, because it is right off the cuff, the obvious candidate.
That's what I'm getting to. And, I made the point that there is since God doesn't need anything to explain or give it to him, then why does the universe need to begin? And that's why I don't see why the universe can't not begin, God not begin, and be contemporaneous or mixed together, whatever you want to phrase it, and just be an element of the tendency rather than a sequence in time. And that you wouldn't have to demonstrate the universe as one entity dependent upon God, but rather, as you mentioned, Thomas Lodge before, I'm not affirming this point of view, I just don't understand quite accurately. You start with one being that definitely does not contain the resource dependent on itself and trace back, and then either the alternative of a chain of all non-dependent beings, a chain of all dependent beings, or all dependent with at least one completely self-sufficient being. In other words, you don't have to show a temporal coming into existence of the world in that line of reason. Not that I'm appalling.
Well, that's absolutely right. And that the point was roughly that we've been talking in the framework of the universe beginning or not beginning, and this individual is pointing out that the cosmological argument in its more sophisticated form involves no commitment as to the eternity or otherwise of the universe, and it still stands up even if the universe is infinite or whether it is or not. This is quite right, and this is the reason why I deliberately avoided taking a stand on either side on that. Nothing that I say is committed either way. Dr. Orr was arguing that there are scientific reasons for thinking the universe began. I happen to think, as a footnote, that those reasons are not particularly impressive. But I don't care. Suppose they're right and the universe did begin, then the argument comes up in its logical form immediately. Supposing they're not right and the universe is infinitely old, the same question arises. But your problem, unfortunately, remains in both forms. It is, and in St. Thomas's original form, it is perfectly clear that if we accept the logic of the argument, which I happen to think there are some defects with, but suppose we accept it, you have still got to show that the self-existent being, the being that exists of itself, is God. You cannot just define it into God, because if we're going to try that trick, then you finish up as a pantheist. The universe exists of itself, and so you better worship it.
Dr. Orr, would you like to react to this, please?
I'd like to just throw in my two cents on one point. If you would talk about infinity, say, in Euclid's geometry, That is a kind of limited infinity, isn't it? But the definition of God that Christians hold is an infinite infinity. It isn't to be compared with Euclid's infinity. In other words, we believe, for instance, the scripture says, heaven of heavens cannot contain thee, like saying the infinity of infinities cannot contain thee. Therefore, I think you're a little severe on the questioner regarding a definition of infinity.
Well, if you want to define a new order of infinity, which is an infinity outside which there is nothing, then it's all right with me. However, this increases the stakes. Now, where are you going to show that there is such an infinity? I mean, we know about the others existing, and so we can handle them. But this one, you've now moved up the scale to the point where we don't even know if even such a concept makes sense.
Of course, the Jewish and Christian answer is right back to the point again where the deity said, I am.
Well, if I'd heard that, I'd be impressed.
Yeah. Question from a lady right here.
That was the mistake, unfortunately. Not at all. I mean, the argument is that reason is something much more general than merely scientific method. Well, an obvious example is the area of reasoning in the law, which is extremely careful, precise, complicated, requires a great deal of learning, is largely analogical, and is extremely like theological reasoning, and it's not scientific reasoning. But there are other areas. I mean, there are forms of logic which are not ever used in science, which are highly, very strictly defined, and very efficient types of reasoning. And also, I think there are cases of intuitive recognition of truths, which can be demonstrated as intuitive recognitions of truths, so that I'm not averse to discussing that kind of thing. It's just that one requires that people that say they're water diviners find some water occasionally. And in the same way, with any alleged extra sense, one just must have some grounds for thinking it's an extra sense and not an extra fooling yourself.
The original question was, what is concerned with reason in addition to scientific proof? And the answer you heard. And the next question was, how does this intuition then differ from faith?
You mean, how does the reliable intuition of somebody who in fact succeeds in demonstrating that they're onto something that we don't know about differ from faith? It differs just because it's succeeded in showing that in fact it does something we can't do. For example, find water when there are no other clues. Or recognize dishonest people by looking at their face, or sick people by looking at ink blots. All of these are cases where you do demonstrate that you're onto something that is an avenue to truth, though you can't explain how you do it.
Would you, any reaction to this, Dr. Orr?
I just think that the inclusion of these other areas widens the scope of our discussion, and for instance, makes a case for the intuition I mentioned, makes a case also for faith, because faith overlaps with reason, I would say.
Well, if you just add a word to that, of course faith overlaps with reason. I mean, there is such a thing as having reasonable faith.
Yes.
And then there's such a thing as having unreasonable faith, and our problem is to decide whether belief in God is reasonable or unreasonable faith.
That's just the issue I say that faces at every turn. It's a binary choice.
Right. Oh, yes, I agree that issue is facing us at every turn.
Question right there.
Dr. Stevens, you said that the main truth that belief in God is beneficial, but it says it's not the question. But the question is whether or not God does exist. Now, assuming that we can prove whether or not God exists, and that we have proved that there is one, but we also prove that it's more beneficial for us to believe that there is one, so we have to believe that there is one, would you say that it is in some way better to a
the question was that Dr. Scriven admits that it may be beneficial to believe in God, but we still may not, he may not exist. But isn't it good still to believe in him, even if he doesn't exist, if it's beneficial?
Yeah, I think that's a good, straightforward request for justification of dishonest thinking, and I think there's no reason not to It's, of course, quite true. I mean, it might turn out that believing that there's a devil watching you all the time and hoping to fry you sooner or later would turn out to be even better for your moral behavior. There are all sorts of interesting speculations that are possible. I mean, Emile Coué founded a clinic in the south of France in which people were cured extensively and systematically by a simple process of standing in front of a mirror 300 times a day and saying every day and every way, I'm getting better and better. Now, he wasn't on to a great truth about them. He was on to the fact that sometimes believing things makes them come true. Now, in the case of the belief in the existence of God, the situation is a little bit worse, because obviously the question of God's existence isn't going to be made true by your believing it. So the question is a very straightforward, naked question as to whether it's in fact going to be the case that you decide to believe falsehoods because it makes you feel better. Well, that is indeed an important question, but it isn't one about their truth. That is, we're interested in a fundamental question. Is there a God? Not in the question, how do we get to be happier, healthier, and fatter through altering our beliefs? The second question is an interesting one, but it isn't the question of the truth of the belief.
May I say, just in case the impression is given that this is Dr. Scriven's view exclusively, at our alma mater at Oxford, we had a symposium. The speaker was Sir David Ross, who was vice chancellor at the time, and C.S. Lewis, the English church philosopher, or theologian, classical scholar, whatever you like to call him. Sir David Ross spoke on the title of the symposium was "The Christian Answer in the World Dilemma," and Sir David Ross said Christianity has not been tried and found wanting. It simply has not been tried. Because if Christianity were tried in international relations, there'd be a cessation of war. If Christianity were tried in family relations, there'd be a cessation of divorce, and so on. He went right down the line. Up got C.S. Lewis and said, Sir David has missed the boat. The big question is not, does Christianity make us nicer neighbors? Because, for instance, he said that little children in December are very well behaved because of Santa Claus, and that's a delusion. On the other hand, he said, in the Soviet Union, many people there think they're better off than in the West, and that keeps them happy. But the big question is it true? Was Jesus Christ born? Was he what he claimed to be? Did he die? Did he rise again? He said, these are the questions of truth. We have scarcely touched on that historical aspect, of course, and I would say that answering the young lady's question, I would have to agree with Dr. Scriven. The fact that it makes people nice isn't the test at all. The big question is it true? But his limits for examining the truth are not my limits. In other words, I'm taking spiritual factors in as well as historical factors and so forth, and he rules out a certain class of evidence.
Oh, no, no. I mean, we're both going to rule out a certain class of evidence, namely bad evidence, right? Now, the question is whether I'm ruling out a class of evidence that is really good evidence. Now, that's what you've got to show. I mean, I'm not sort of saying the only thing that's going to count is what I can count with my fingers or with Geiger counters. I'm prepared to admit anything that can be demonstrated as being evidence, scientific or not, the definition of evidence being very simple. It is that which increases the probability of the conclusion which we allege it to be evidence for. So I'm not ruling out, I mean, you said, the way you put it just then was that you're in taking account of spiritual truths. I'm for spiritual truths and material truths and mathematical truths, and in fact, in general, for truth in a sort of mild way. But what I have to be shown is that it's a spiritual truth that I'm ruling out. Not a feeling.
Well, you see, it leaves us with the same dilemma, and that is that if you take the definition of God given in the sacred scriptures we're referring to, if you use Euclid's logic and say, let's see if this is true by applying it, I would say that the case is quite good. If you won't examine it or won't apply it, then, of course, we, by stalling it and simply saying, well, you haven't proved yet that there is a God, therefore I'm not going to examine his claims, I think we just get nowhere. Yes. And most of these questions are coming up are really what you might call asking us to clear up very fine points of either point of view.
It's very obvious, of course, we're not going to get to nearly all of the questions. In fact, we're under some pressure of time now, so we'll have one more question, and then we'll have the summary statements. And I promise a question to the gentleman right over near the wall.
arguments for the existence of God don't establish God, neither do they fail to establish God. Depend more on your point of departure and your criteria for various arguments. But, for Dr. Scriven, how could God have arranged the arguments so that they would work, as you seem to want them to, and still preserve man's freedom to believe or not to believe, which is a very important New Testament doctrine?
The question is that we have not proved that God does not exist or proved that he does exist. The question then, how could God have arranged arguments so that Dr. Scriven could prove what he has proved tonight?
How could God have arranged that the arguments in the case of God would work and still preserve man's freedom to believe in God or not to believe in God, which in fact is a very important doctrine in the New Testament?
Yeah, I think, may I try and summarize? This is an extremely ingenious argument, roughly of the following form. If the arguments worked, well, then we'd have to believe, and then we wouldn't be free to believe or not believe. And that would take away our freedom, and of course freedom is more important than anything else, so therefore it's essentially, you might put it this way, it's essential to God's nature that the arguments for his existence not work. Now, if only you could prove that, then you would really have the neatest proof to settle all this kind of issue that has ever been produced. But let me remind you of a couple of the awkward consequences of that kind of line. It reminds me a little bit of the clergyman in Mackerel Plaza, who was an extremely liberal church, which was a community church used by all faiths, and a number that were not very obviously faiths too. And he gave a sermon in which he went on about God's remarkable qualities, and at the end of it all, having talked about these, he said, "And when you come to think of it, perhaps the most astonishing and truly remarkable quality of God is the fact that he can do all these things without even existing." Now, arguments which purport to show that there can't be arguments which would work in a certain field, but that nevertheless you ought to believe the conclusion, are very much in that category. And in this particular case, I would like to reply by saying something very simple. It's just a question in reply. If providing evidence for the existence of things takes away our freedom, then aren't we very badly threatened by chairs and tables? And if not, why not? May I ask him that question?
I would say that the evidence that you're looking for can only be seen from inside the faith. Now, you can see that it's logically coherent, existentially it satisfies the meaning of your life in a way that you cannot see standing outside and disbelieving. Therefore, the evidence is supplied to the person who chooses to believe.
You have obviously never taken a sympathetic interest in the mental processes of lunatics. Because it's quite clear that these are internally consistent and that they satisfy the existential needs of the lunatic. Now, it doesn't in the least follow from this that Christians are lunatics or that atheists are lunatics. It just follows that the suggestion that internal consistency and the satisfaction of needs constitute a ground for truth is hopeless.
All right, Dr. Orr, would you like to react to this question and go into your five-minute summary of the argument?
I'll summarize. In the last question, Dr. Scriven said something about God arranging that these arguments should not work. That's his definition of not working. I say these arguments are congenial to established facts of science. It gets back to the old question again. However, may I just mention this? I think someone said, I'm not quite sure if it was here, that I'd hitchhiked, maybe I said it myself, I'd hitchhiked from Tokyo to Oxford, 24,000 miles. Now, I went westward, I hitchhiked across Korea, then China, on the way up to the capital of Chongqing and over at Gunming, over the Himalayas and so on, all across the old landmass of the old world. It'd be very difficult for me to reestablish this. I couldn't go back to Shanghai and collect evidence. They wouldn't let me in, no doubt. It'd be difficult to go to Chongqing. But on what depends my credibility? Now, Dr. Scriven, no doubt, could easily establish that instead of going westward, as I did, I could have gone eastward on a troop ship, as many other men did. In fact, nearly everybody else did. Practically every American soldier went eastward on a troop ship or on a plane, whereas I hitchhiked west. The fact that there's an alternative to my claim doesn't mean it's invalid. And that's the point I've been harping on. The fact that God gives us an alternative, in other words, an out, he will compel no man's faith. With every probability, there's this chance. I would simply say the arguments could not be construed as not working, but simply that they are valid, but there are alternatives, and one of the alternatives is the one that he's so ably given. Therefore, to say that it's like a counsel of despair to try and work this out, I think is beside the point. Now, to summarize my point of view, I will simply say again, I begin with my definition of God. God is the only infinite, eternal, unchangeable spirit, the being in whom all things begin, continue, and end. That's the Christian revelation in a nutshell. It could be very much more expanded, but that would take ever so long. But that's a simple statement. We get this as a revelation from the prophets and from Jesus Christ. We receive it by an insight we call faith, and that this worldview is not inconsistent with the facts of science or any widely accepted theories of science. Therefore, it's not impossible to believe. Furthermore, it's been believed by people of the highest intellectual caliber, not by people who've got confused brains only. We've got, of course, people with confused brains on both sides. That we admit. But that this has brought untold blessing wherever taught to the human race, both the life of nations and the life of individuals. I would dearly love to speak on this subject sometime, but this is not the proper time or place. So I feel that Dr. Scriven has provided the alternative, and it's a question of making your choice, whether you believe in this counsel of no answer or accept the answer given to us by the deity. You say that's circular reasoning? Well, you can't deal with the fact of revelation without taking it out of the realm of being able to prove it entirely by reason.
It's difficult to sum up what has been, and this is something I regret, mainly a critical discussion. The discussion must be critical one way or the other. If I had been the first speaker, then I would have been the one who was criticized. I want to make two short points about some of the questions that were raised that I think we didn't say enough about, and then finish with a comment about what I see the alternatives to be. Might one not believe in God because one feels that this does improve one's way of life? This young lady asked this question, and I was very anxious in answering to distinguish between believing something or discussing something to find out whether it's true and believing it because it makes you feel good in the gut. Now, I think it's important to look that question in the eyes and see that you're selling yourself for that feeling, if that's what you decide to do. But I want to strengthen my reply slightly by saying this. Believing in something when there isn't any evidence to believe in it is bad, not good. For that reason, it is bad to believe what isn't true. It is particularly bad to believe something that, in fact, could be shown to be false. You must first decide whether that is the status of God's existence and not conceal yourself from the deliberations of this discussion by immersing yourself in a faith to begin with. Secondly, it is, in my view, the case that quite apart from the fact that it's morally bad to believe falsehoods, it is in fact psychologically bad. It is not, I think, a good thing to believe in God. It is not a good thing. It is a bad thing, and not just for you, but also for those whose behavior is affected by your behavior. Because you cannot buy God as a pure belief without consequences for your actions. The belief in God must have, in any Christian faith, in every Christian faith, consequences for your actions. Now, those actions will affect others. And the question is, how do you justify affecting others in that way? By preventing them from seeing certain sorts of film, reading certain sorts of book, wearing certain sorts of clothes, using certain kinds of device to prevent having children. How do you defend interfering with their life in that way? If religion is a personal matter, if it's a matter of just electing a choice, partly because you think that life is better this way, then you are giving that as your basis for interfering with the lives of others, and that is not a good enough basis. So I do not like the idea of the consequences of that kind of approach. In particular, I am very unhappy about the suggestion that Dr. Orr added just now, that there really have been untold blessings to the life of nations and individuals following from Christianity, partly because I wouldn't deny that there have been many such blessings, but this isn't the important question. The question is, could they have been attained, perhaps with extra blessings, in another way? And to answer that question is extremely difficult. As things stand, it's always easy to say the Inquisition wasn't part of the tradition, to reject the parts you don't like. But there's an awful lot of it. And what is there left? What does a Christian stand for in morality? Does he stand for adultery or against it? For contraception or against it? For suicide or against it? For dancing or against it? Smoking or against it? Liquor or against it? Christians stand on every side of every moral issue. Christianity is not a moral position. It is the name for a range of moral positions. You get no answer to the question you ask about morality from the conclusion that Christianity is the answer to your view of life. And for the further answers as to which particular Christian sect with its associated moral views you are to elect requires a kind of argumentation that goes far beyond anything Dr. Orr was producing today, and in my view is far, far less convincing. And yet it is that that affects our relationships one with another. So you've got to bite off a lot more than just Christianity, let alone just theism. You've got to find something that supports those practical moral decisions that you make. And you won't find that in Christianity as such or theism as such. And you won't find it in the inspiration of Christ's life, because people inspired by Christ's life are on both sides of those fences. Now it is that doubt and worry, that need for answers to those further questions that matter, that leads me to look elsewhere for a foundation for the decisions you must make, for the approach you have to life and to other people. It follows from the doctrine of Christ's divinity and of Christ's sacrifice to save us that we, in fact, are brothers in Christ, that we have an obligation to each other because of that brotherhood in Christ. For me, it seems more important to face that brotherhood directly, to worship not a distant God or an ancient Christ, but to value the brothers that you have, not because they're brothers in Christ, but because they're fellow human beings. You must short-circuit the theological chain of arguments that leads you to the conclusion that you should value your neighbors. You must get down to the fact that in the long run, you must value them, and we must all value them, because they're humans, and not because of some theological superstructure. And in that state of affairs, you may have to face the realities of moral life in a way that will strip you down to the point where you begin to argue moral arguments on the basis of things that really can be established. Things about what happens to a society that does not respect the life or the welfare of others. The utilitarian approach to morality, getting down to it as a system of laws for running a society which has to run. Now, if we get down to that level, we get a lot more agreement. It is for this reason that I actively oppose the arguments for the existence of God or Christianity. It is because I see through that method no hope of solving the problems that we have to solve. It has had its run for thousands of years, and at the end of the thousands of years, moral issues find Christians on both sides. We have got to do better than that, and we have not got very long in which to decide how to do it. I am an evangelist too, but on the other side, I am an evangelist in the sense that I try to convert people away from a belief in which I think there is no foundation to beliefs which I think can be founded, because they must come to those decisions. They must come to these conclusions and provide a foundation for thinking about these issues. And in my view, it cannot be found the other way, and so it must be found this way. So I have a positive faith. It is the faith in man, and it is the belief that without that faith, not sent around through the long route, through a being who does not exist, but the direct belief in man, face to face, it is through this route and only through this route that we can hope to solve the problems which we now face, and for which we have not very much time to solve.